Before we get started, I'd like to make an announcement. Now, I'm sure that nobody who's sober did this, but there's a Dodge Rambler in the parking lot. The license number is 2K58311. The car is locked and the motor's running.
Really?
Yeah, I hope they're at the basketball game.
But Dodge never made a ramp.
Dodge Rampage. Yeah, it's a little more classier. It probably belongs to an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Before we get this thing started, I'd like to make a couple of announcements. I would like to extend my appreciation to Mr. Johnny Crean for securing this beautiful place to have this meeting for Chuck. And I think maybe we owe him an applause. He did a lot of work just to get it there. Also, there is a big expense for this building, and I'm not going to have the baskets passed, but after the meeting's over, there'll be somebody stationed at every door with a basket, so let your conscience be your guide on that thing. If you would all join me in the serenity prayer, please. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. When you came in, I hope you came in, you were given one of these little folders with a picture of Papa on it. And to give you a little history in the background of this picture was taken at Palo Mesa on the weekend that he made the 6 tapes that the book A New Pair of Glasses is taken from, and also the caption and the inside of it is taken from that same book. So you'll all know it's something for you to take home to remember. And I'd like to call Harvey A. from West Covina to come up here and read the 5th chapter.
My name's Harvey Andrews, and I'm an alcoholic. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us had tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which I suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if sought.
How many people, just for my own personal curiosity, in this audience ever made a trip up the hill with a problem or something to talk to Papa? Would you all stand so we could see from up here? The ones who made a trip up there with problems that he talked to you about. As you know, we're gathered up probably in this memorial meeting for our beloved Chuck, who's gone on into the other room. And what we're going to try to do is we're just going to try to have just an AA meeting, because I think that's what he'd want. And kick it off is, I'm even going to break a tradition. I'm going to have an Al-Anon talk first. So, without further ado from me, how about a real warm welcome for a real lovely lady, Elsa.
Somebody just said to me, we love you, but you guys don't know how much I love you. If it weren't for you, I would not have had the many years of joyous friendship with all of you since Chuck got sober. All of you know that I'm going to miss him terribly, but he needed to go. I want you to know that. He was ready to go. The last 3 days that he lived, all the necessity to get well and to be left, and he was ready to go. And when he was ready to go, he went. And he was sitting in his chair in the living room where he loved to be, looking out at the ocean that he loved so well, and Catalina Island that he speaks of so often. So maybe you and I can together allow him the freedom and the joy of walking to another room. God bless you all.
And 2 years ago, Christmas, Chuck got a Christmas present in the nature of his son who got sober in our fellowship. So I'd like to have him come up and say a couple of words to you, Bill.
My name is Bill C., and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
It's kind of imposing. I know Mom expressed it, but before I forget, I want to express to all of you the great strength of the love and sympathy and consideration that's been expressed to the whole family. It's been a marvelous thing to feel it. Don't have to say anything, you just feel things in this organization, and it comes through, and it's beautiful. And I thank you, and my mom thanks you, and my brother thanks you, and my daughter Carol thanks you, and the whole family. The memories I have of Dad are many and varied. I've seen him. I was 18 years old when he sobered up, so I saw a lot of his tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot phase. And he was. But he operated beautifully in between those periods, somehow. Then he came to this program back in 1946, knowing he was going to die, and he wanted to set the record straight. And he spent almost 39 years doing just that, setting the record straight. He's seen to it that Mom's taken care of, that all things are well with her forevermore. He saw this black sheep, prodigal son, come back to the fold and join up. I became one. And incidentally, I love it. I wouldn't be any place else but right here with you people right now. And that's a beautiful feeling, to know you're where you belong, with the people with whom you belong. He saw his youngest son achieve the pinnacles of his profession. He'd be here, except he's in Zimbabwe or someplace, and shooting a movie, you know, a sit-down movie, which is great. And he saw all that, and he said it was well, but I think he hung on for a while longer because he had a granddaughter that was to him the daughter that he'd never had, he and Mom had never had. And she was out there shooting it up and doing her thing and pretending. Well, she's got 100 days on the program today. And I believe he looked all this over. And he says to the God as he understood him, he says, "Dad, we've about done it here. Let's go on to the other place and do some more. Let's get to work." And I was talking to Clancy a little bit before the meeting, and something occurred to me that I had been thinking about a lot, and that's when Mom and I sat there in the living room on that Friday when he walked into the other room. And when I got down there, he was in bed, and he looked bad, and he'd had a stroke, and his mouth was pulled over to the side, and just didn't look good. And Judy, the nurse, I helped a little bit, and we got him into his chair, and got him looking at his view, like Mom was talking about, and we watched him go. And I'll be darned if that mouth didn't go back to normal. And he looked at peace. And that was beautiful. And but for this program, for God as I understand him and you people, I'd have missed all that. And I want to thank you.
Did he?
Yeah, my name's Ed, and I really am an alcoholic. I always say that because I don't look like one. Elsa says I don't look like one either. My wife, Jenny, Elsa says the casserole was terrific. Right? Anyway, when this all first happened, I got a little bit taken in by it. I'm, you know, you're used to something, and I haven't been on this planet that long, but over half of it, but I've been a member of this fellowship. And I've always had a man either in Beverly Hills or Laguna Beach that, I don't mean I called him all the time or I followed him around like a little puppy, but I knew he was there, and that's really all that counted in a fight. But the reason I didn't like to call him is because he would give you dumb answers like, you know, like, stay close, or he would draw you a circle, and then he would say something like, you see that out there? He'd be looking out that window, and I'd say, yeah, I see that out there. I didn't want to say I didn't see that out there. And I'd say, yeah, I see that out there. I want to think I was half wise anyway, you know. And he would say, that all belongs to me. And I said, oh, yeah? You know, I'm trying to get spiritual, you know, and I figured there's no better place than Bayview Drive. So he said, the reason it belongs to me is because I don't have to have it. He told me that when he first moved in there, like, what, about 25 years ago? Then I realized that it's, you know, that's kind of what it's all about, because some of us, you know, are leaving the planet prematurely. And I don't think there's anything wrong with leaving the planet or dying. It's part of living. But I don't think any of us should have to leave before we die, before we live. And there are some of us that never have lived. I never lived until I had to walk into Burbank 33 years and 1 month and 3 days ago. And it just so happens that, coincidentally, that man happened to be there. Now, if you smoked as much dope as I have and were as paranoid as I am to have somebody up there laughing at you, it is pretty frightening. But over the years, what the man has meant to me and Elsa, of course, I've been a lot closer to, in a lot of ways, to Elsa than I have Chuck, because I wasn't afraid of her. We go places on airplanes like Texas, and I would sit with her because I didn't know what to say to him. I swear, I'm not kidding. And one time we went to Texas, and on the way back he said he's not taking us with him anymore. You remember that? Because we were funny. and he cried that meeting. Remember the whole meeting? He cried. Really, that was back in 57. We were going to Arkansas. Well, I don't tell you. But what that man has meant to me over the years, and I really become aware of it today in a subtle way, and I won't go into it, is that Alcoholics Anonymous is such a subtle, individualized program. Chuck used to use such expressions that at first used to turn me off when I used to hear him say them, because I didn't know what they meant. They're too simplistic, like I have a God of my very own. You know, that sounds like, oh, come on now, how about cut me in? You know what I mean? And I never knew what he meant. And what he was really saying, and you know, anybody that is that simple is going to be misunderstood sometimes, particularly by grassheads like me. Okay? And what he's saying, and what he has always said, and what he was the epitome of, as far as I'm concerned, and I see this in him now, I see it better now than I've ever seen before, is that Chuck was one of the few people I know in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous who was himself. He was himself. He was himself. He was not a clone. He was himself. I have never seen anybody that was more himself than he was. And what he was trying to tell me from the very, very beginning, Ed, you're okay. You just keep coming back and become you, and that's the last thing I want to be, is me. Because I don't like me. But I find out that what I am, created by my creator, my very own God, I am my own very own God now, is that I'm beautiful. I always have been. But you see, I'm the last to know. Now, when I went to see Chuck in the hospital, the last time he was at Hogue, I didn't think he was really paying much attention to me, you know. I mean, it's me, Eddie, the grasshopper. Hi there, you know. And I don't know what it is. I'm sure that some of these other gentlemen up here felt that. But all of us, I think, have always felt like we'd like to win a special little spot. That to where when you would call, he would say, I'll drop everything, Eddie's coming up. Never happened. And so I could see that he needed rest, because the man said he wasn't going to be there by midnight, which was months and before he actually went into the other room. And I'll never forget, he had tears in his eyes. Elsa had been there, but she had left. She had gone someplace. And my wife, Jenny, and me were there. And I started to leave. And I looked down at him, and he had great big tears in his eyes. And he had that little smile that I've seen, that the reason I'm alive today. And I started to give him a kiss on the forehead, and I wasn't going to cut it with him. He wanted a kiss right here. So I gave him a kiss on the mouth. And I pulled back, and he looked up at me, and this is what he said. He said, you remember this. I have loved you for a long, long time. And I get to thinking, isn't it fantastic that people love you when you're nothing? They love you when you think you're nothing, and they keep loving you, and you keep loving you, and tell you to keep coming back and say your dumb little things like, stay close, find your very own God, work the program, share whenever you can, you know, read the big book and all that dumb stuff. And years later, you find out that the reason they loved you is because you were beautiful all the time, you know. And that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is epitomized by a man like him who is the epitome of simplicity and love. And guys like me, I'm here today because I happened to walk into a room in Burbank over 33 years ago. I was about to leave the planet. And instead of leaving, I stayed here to learn to live and learn to love. And the one thing I have today, I may not have anything else. I'm nobody. I don't, you know, I'm in a... There's a 1,500,000 people in the world don't even know who I am. And there's a few little people in Southern California that recognize me at an AA meeting. I work for a newspaper right now, and there's nobody in there except one drunk who went to a meeting once, and he won't talk to me. And I don't think that anything in the world is more exciting than being somewhere where you know you're somebody when they don't know you're anybody, than to be somewhere where you think you're somebody where they know you're nobody. So I'm nobody that's getting better, and it's a lot in part due to my loving friend. Now, my dad is gone, but my mom is still here, so she'll be hearing from me from time to time. Thank you very much.
As far as I know, and I really don't know whether it's true or not, but I suppose it's true. The next lady that I'm going to call up here to this podium, as far as I know, she can correct me, is the oldest sober lady alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think. And if she ain't, I stand corrected. Sybil? She's not the oldest. She has the most variety.
Johnny, you were right in the first place. The oldest, true, that too. Let's see, how old am I? My name is Sybil Corbin, and I sure am an alcoholic. And I'm honored that I was asked to participate in this meeting today. It means a great deal to me to be here with all of you, Bill, Elsa, Johnny, all of you, and any newer people. And I know there were some, because I talked to them when we were having coffee. People from out of state came a long way from Oregon and other places to be here. I wouldn't have wanted to miss this. I really wouldn't have. No way at all. My sobriety date is March 1941 because I read a Saturday Evening Post article written by Jack Alexander while I was sobering up in a Turkish bath after 17 years of boozing and not being able to quit. I wrote for help. Ruth Hawk, Bill Wilson's secretary, answered my letter for help and told me where it was. And so it was that I went down to the first California meeting. There were about a dozen men there. And I haven't had a drink since. And the women started streaming in. And we can testify to that today, that there are thousands upon thousands of very sober women. Oh, incidentally, he called me a lady. And we had a committee meeting in 1941, a few women that came in at that time, because they were calling us the lady alcoholics. And we had a sort of a committee meeting, had a little separate meeting away from the fellows during while they were meeting, and decided that we didn't want to be called lady alcoholics, that we were not ladies, especially when we were drinking, and that we wanted to be known from the word go, as AA grew, that we were women alcoholics. And so it is that in your meeting directory, at least in California, they will list the women's groups. And I like that very much. The Chamberlains, such precious people. I've never loved people more in my life than I love Chuck and Elsa, and then meeting Bill 2 years ago at the Big Book group. And I've thought of them constantly these last difficult days. And remembering the fond, sweet memories of Chuck, I'll share a few with you. And let me look at somebody's watch here. I've forgotten who I got it from. I may not give it back. I'll be all right, I think, with about what I have to say. I didn't meet Chuck when he first got sober in 1946. It was a while, and I don't remember when it was. But eventually, my brother Tex, and probably wasn't too long, Elsa will know, my brother Tex asked him to talk at the Hole in the Ground, which at that time was really upstairs and not the Hole in the Ground. It was the Ebell Club on Clarendon and Huntington Park, where it is today. But they rented the basement, and the guys would point down on Sunday night to where that meeting was and say, as I was saying last Thursday at the Hole in the Ground, and the basement become known as the Hole in the Ground, Tex had Chuck there. And I don't know whether I was in town or not, because I don't remember that meeting, but I became acquainted with him very shortly after that. And I particularly remember a ride with Chuck up to Grants Pass, Oregon. Now, inside, many times I'm a frightened mouse. Maybe I don't show it, but I know I was a little scared. I was working at the central office, a little new there, too, and afraid the people wouldn't love me and that I wouldn't be adequate. Although I had been a secretary and a good one and so on, and had answered the phones at the Hole in the Ground for years, still I was frightened. And I went out to the airport, and there stood Chuck with an overcoat and a hat on, so it had to be fall or winter. And I was a little in awe of him, though I'd heard him speak, and he had talked at the Vernon Hayloft when Bob Foreman, my husband, he and Jim Willis had started that, and Chuck had come out on a stormy night and had been our first speaker. And it was pouring. He was soaked to the skin. And yet he came. He never failed to come, regardless of the circumstances. And Bob was talking about that today. There was Chuck in a storm that no one would have thought a thing about getting on the phone and saying, hey, you know what? I can't make it. It's a long drive. There's a flood. The streets are flooded with water. It would be dangerous. I can't be there. Chuck was. And so it was that riding up there to Grants Pass with him, I was put at ease almost immediately. The next day I wore a little green dress. It was a little green jersey dress. And he called me his little green frog. The dress happened to be that color, and it was mottled, M-O-T-T-L-E-D, and he called me his little green frog. But the thing that happened that was so amazing there and pleased me so much is those people at the hayloft, this rough barn-like place where he had come to speak in the rain. Madeline and Grant Swayze were some of the very active couples there, the man and wife team. And they had moved to Grant's Pass, and they were a little earthy. They were lovable people. Grant was a great big burly guy who used rough language. And they saw us there in Grant's Pass and said, come to our house in the morning and have breakfast. And without looking at me, Chuck said, "Certainly, I'll be there. Will you, Sib?" I said, "Sure." And so we went out way out in the boondock someplace, and it was muddy as could be, and Grant and Madeline said, "Would you like to see our horses and cows?" And Chuck said, "Why, sure." And I looked at my high heels, and we walked out of that muck and mire up past our ankles, and they showed us every chicken and horse and cow, that dogs and everything else that they had, before Madeline served us the hot biscuits that she had promised Chuck. Now, that's an event that I remember in great detail because it was just utterly charming. It was wonderful. And Chuck waded around there and seemed to thoroughly enjoy it. I think he enjoyed life in all its aspects. I remember one other time, and he was always doing this, when asked, never butting in. But any time I was in trouble or worried about something that was big, I called Laguna. I talked, if Chuck wasn't there, I talked to Elsa and got my answers, just fine answers, and was greatly relieved. I never hesitated to call down there when I was in a jackpot, call down there when I wasn't. I didn't do it too much, and I'll tell you why. I figured they were so busy with other people in deep trouble that I had no right to monopolize the telephone. Otherwise, I'd have called them twice a day, but I didn't. I thought they'd be too busy. But having known them so long and to see their boy come into Alcoholics Anonymous is a fabulous thing. It is a fabulous thing. And I think that's a word that Chuck used a lot. The thing that I will mention, as I put this on today, this medallion, and I put it on every time I go to a meeting, the hole in the ground gave me a kind of a surprise 40-year sober birthday meeting. It's really what it was. And they had a little girl come up on the stage there and hand me 40 American Beauty roses, one for every year that I was sober. And then they had Chuck present me with this medallion. And you remember that, Elsa? And it has XL on there for 40 years. And I couldn't believe it was me. It was like I was looking at a movie of old Mary Pickford or whoever. It just couldn't be me. A sleazy little drunk that was down on Skid Row sometimes when I couldn't get booze or drinking Padre wine from a drugstore, and you never heard of that. I hope you never do. But that's the way it was. And I was always so comfortable. Every time that I could be near them or with them or on the phone in person. And I want to tell you, in closing, what I was thinking about as I was sitting down there today. We haven't heard the last of Chuck. Do you realize that when he came in, as far as I know, we didn't have tape recorders, did we, Eddie? I don't think so. At any rate, now, for the rest of our lives, and long after we're gone, all of these drunken kids out there and their kids' kids will hear tapes of Chuck. I don't know how many years ahead that this could possibly go, that they will be hearing his talks. And I think that that is a permanent thing that I've just said, that it will always be thus. Oh, I love you all so much. I love you especially, Elsa and Bill. Johnny, you're so good to me, and Clancy is good to me. Everybody is, and I don't deserve it, but I'll take it. I love you all. Thank you very much.
We love you, too. This guy, when I got the word that Pop had left, I picked up the phone and I called Cease because I knew he wanted to know. And he was broken up because he couldn't come for the family service. And I said, "Well, with any kind of luck, Cease, maybe we can have a memorial for Pop." And he said, "I'll come to that." And I picked him up from the airport this morning, and I know that this guy loved Pop a great deal, but I'm going to let him tell you about it. From Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada, CC.
My name is Cease Clark, I'm an alcoholic. And I've had some big things to do in my life. And I've been around it, not around this program. I feel I've been in this program since January 16th, 1952. I've been privileged to be with you people in California many, many times. Probably the toughest jobs I've had to do in Alcoholics Anonymous was in Lubbock, Texas. They flew me there to introduce Chuck. And everybody knew Chuck. And they spent $500 to take me down there. Because I come from a long ways from here. Then they flew me to Minneapolis twice to introduce Chuck. They've never let me speak there, but they got me introduced Chuck. For you see, I've known Chuck for a long, long, long time. Met him back in Canada in 1957. Learned to love him, and he learned to love me. We were in Longview, Texas one time. Eddie was there. And the people made a deal that Chuck and I, he representing the United States, me representing Canada, that we were going to walk across the pool at midnight. And Chuck was holding court, and a bunch of people around him, and I saw that. I looked over, but I showed up with my gang. Chuck didn't arrive. When I went in the morning, somebody said to me, "Where's Chuck?" And I said, "The last time I saw him was midnight. He was at the bottom of the pool." And I have had so many great times with this man. But the worst time I ever had with him was, I think, 1970, 71 or somewhere. I spoke at San Diego at the Southern California Convention. I went to spend a few days with Chuck and Elsa. And Chuck drove me in that big Lincoln back to Laguna Beach. I don't know whether any of you have ever ridden with Chuck on a Sunday afternoon from San Diego to Laguna Beach. I got home and I'm like this, you see? And Babe said, "Why don't you put your arms down?" I said, "I can't." I said, "They were stuck there from riding with Chuck from San Diego to Laguna Beach." You know, this afternoon, we talked about Chuck going to the other room. And I just want you to visualize this. Saturday afternoon up there. And Chuck already has called the meeting to order. Al Mano's arguing a bit with him. They've probably invited Willie and Bob along too. Come to the meeting. Probably Clarence Snyder is arguing of who's the oldest member up there. And my friend Mac Cheater is saying there's no problem. Everything's going to be all right.
Would you turn the tape over right now, please?
A great meeting. And they're probably all saying, "Well, we got those people down in Long Beach doing exactly what we wanted to do on a Saturday afternoon. And isn't it great that we can remember them that way? Because that's the way that they were, and that's the way that they are today. And that great roundup up there is probably well attended tonight at that meeting by a bunch of people that left us a legacy, by a bunch of people that showed us the way. And they left us just a whole lot of work to do. Because I can remember many, many, many years ago in Swift Current, Saskatchewan, Canada, Tommy Myers, who is also at that other room now, and Chuck and I driving out into a wheat field, and Chuck telling me that to get ready, that I was going to be gone from home every weekend. And that was the purpose in life that probably God had given to me. And I have never argued it, because I know that that was probably the only purpose in, the good purpose in life I've ever had. And Chuck taught me something else. And I tell the story, and I told it when I introduced him at different places. It's a story, and you've all heard it, about a great actor that was asked to say the 23rd Psalm at a great meeting, something like this, and how he went home and rehearsed it, and how he stood in front of the mirror, and how he taped it, as any great actor would do, and to get it absolutely perfect. The Sunday before he was supposed to say this 23rd Psalm, he went to church. And quite by coincidence, the minister said the 23rd Psalm. The great night arrived, and the great actor said the 23rd Psalm, "Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." And when it was all over, he received a standing ovation. And he came back up to the microphone, and he asked the people to be seated. And he said, "I have a friend of mine in the audience who is my minister. And I'd like him to come up and say the 23rd Psalm." And the minister came up and said the 23rd Psalm the way it's supposed to be said, from the heart and not from the mouth. And when it was all over, there was no great standing ovation or anything. There were a lot of tears in a lot of people's eyes. And the great actor once again went to the microphone, and he said, "You see, the difference is that between my minister friend and myself, is that I know the sheep, but he knows the shepherd." And Chuck taught me how to know both the sheep and the shepherd. And I'm sure he's taught many of you here today that we are very, very, very privileged people, every one of us. And let's never forget it, that we are privileged to know both the sheep and the shepherd. Thank you very much.
Clancy. My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I feel very privileged to be on the stage today with a lot of distinguished people whom I respect and admire, and I see them out in the hall. That's a remarkable occasion. And I have kind of a I'm kind of a streak of negative is in me. I was sitting here thinking, I hope all the people who aren't here feel as good tonight as those of us who are here will feel. Because there are people here from all over the Western world, and I'm sure there are this many people within 3 miles of here who found it inconvenient. And that's why I want to stay with the activists who are willing to take the actions. And that's what I most respected about Chuck C., is that he was an activist. When I was new, I never liked him as a person. He was such a smiley, greasy... First time I ever heard him talk was in the 6300 Club on Thanksgiving, 1958. And he swept in. And, you know, when you're living in the back seat of an abandoned car and you have no front teeth and you can't find anybody in the club who wants to sit down with you, It makes you crazy to have someone come in who is loved. You can just hear the hum. It's him. Oh. And I thought, I was so upset that when he began to talk, I got up and left. As I've often said, I don't know if the meeting continued or not. They may have... And from then on, he was just a... There's nothing worse than when you're doing bad than see someone who's doing everything good. It just makes you sick for years. Everywhere you go, Chuck is coming next week. Oh, are they? That's really funny. And I had a sponsor who was very strong, and he finally died when I was a couple of years sober. He had done me a lot of good. He had given me actions to take, and he had told me, if you don't take these actions, you'll get drunk. And after a couple of years, he stopped taking them. After I was a couple of years sober, he was 15 years sober. And he stopped taking them, and he got drunk, just almost like an exclamation point. See what I mean? You know. And it sounds sacrilegious, but it really was. People said to me, boy, it must be tough for you because your sponsor's dead and you weren't any too strong when he was here. I told him the same thing. No, he did exactly, he proved to be exactly what he said. And I've told this story before, but I don't know another way to say it. 5 years later, on my 7th birthday, I had become, at least in my minority opinion, magnificent. I was the Sunday afternoon speaker on my birthday, my 7th birthday, at the Southern California Convention in Bakersfield. The leader was someone I sponsored. The first speaker was someone I sponsored. The meeting stopped in the middle so Polly Hall could come down the hall. And I thought the cake was for me, but she had an eye going either direction. I was just kind of... She brought me a cake for 7 candles, and I didn't even realize what a thing this was. I just thought, just my due, you know, okay. Thanks, Polly, now get out of here. And on the way back, I was riding with Charlotte and a couple, a little guy named Tommy O'Mara and another guy, and I was coming over the grapevine. I thought, now who will I call? Who would I call if I got in trouble? I haven't had a sponsor for 5 years. And I thought, I went through all the names I knew in AA, and not one of them were up to my standards. I thought, maybe Bill Wilson. And then I thought, no, I don't like his position on niacin. And there wasn't anyone left. And I suddenly thought, I probably am never closer to being drunk than I am at this moment. There is no one up to my standards. So I thought, I got to get a sponsor. Now, I believe in action. I mean, to me, action is a form of, is the most sincere prayer I know. Doing. It's easy to mouth it, harder to do it sometimes, as Sybil mentioned, go out in those rainstorms and so on. And I had to find someone ahead of me. I found out you don't have to like your sponsor, but you have to respect him. And I thought, who's the most active guy I know? And I thought, old Chuck C. with his gray suit and his gray Lincoln and his vivid message. So I called him up the next morning down on Alameda Street, Riverside. I'd like to say, this is Clancy. I'd like to come over and talk to you, Chuck. He said, all right, come over. And I went down there and I said, Chuck, I've been thinking about it. And I'd like to ask you to be my sponsor. And he said, my goodness, I was at Bakersfield yesterday afternoon and heard you speak. And I thought maybe you were coming down here to offer to be my sponsor. And it all went to hell after that forever. And he didn't much approve of me. So I spent the next 10 years working to get his approval. I did a lot of things to get his approval. I'll tell you how bad, you know, after working at it 10 years in that book, A New Pair of Glasses, he gives me a barely acceptable mention. And that was after 10 years of impressing him. But he was unfailingly was what I wanted him to be. A man out in front doing what he said. There's a lot of talkers. Very few people who do what they say. And in a sense, it's really inspiring. Sometimes it's such an aggravation. I mentioned this at the family service, but it just always held up to me as how it can work the other way. I was working down in an advertising agency downtown. I'd had a terrible week. It was the middle of the summer and it was hot. I came home on that freeway and drivers were goofy. I looked at my calendar. I had to go to someplace like Oil City or some outside of Bakersfield, where Bakersfield is beyond any length, and outside of that. And I thought to myself, you know, this is not normal living. Book says return to normal living. I'm tired and I'm hot and every driver on the road is a craphead today, and even Chuck can understand that. And I called him up and I said, Chuck, I want to talk to you. I'm supposed to go to Oildale tonight. He says, I can't talk to you right now. I'm on my way to Big Bear. Give me a call tomorrow. What a crap. Get up. I'll tell you, I drove to Oildale thinking, that smarmy old puke. But that's what people like me need, is someone out there to do it. And the one other thing that I most remember about Chuck, and again, I mentioned this before, he had no, absolutely no standards of who he should grant audiences to. I have talked to him again and again. I have said, Chuck, that guy is a phony. He's a goof. Don't talk to him. Just God's kid. I'm like one of these immigrants. As soon as they get to America, they want to raise the immigration rules, you know. But he talked to... I work in a Skid Row mission. I talk to everybody, but there are some people I wouldn't talk to. But he talked to everybody. It just made me terribly cross. Come on, Chuck, have some standards for Christ's sake. I don't like him. Don't talk to him. Makes you just crazy. And I was thinking about this when Chuck passed away. He's going to leave a tremendous hole in this world in AA. I would say that probably outside of Dr. Bob and Bill, he probably was the best known AA that ever lived. Ever in the world. We take him for granted, but that's what he was. Cecil is well known, known all over the world. Johnny's well known all over the world. Eddie's well known. Sybil's known. Bill, nobody ever heard of Bill. All right. But he's still young. But Chuck was the best known man in the world in AA. And you know, they always say a prophet is without honor save in his own town. We all love Chuck, but we forget. He is venerated all over the world. I've been getting calls from all over the world saying, just heard about Chuck. Got a call from the London Embassy, American Embassy in London this week. And a call from Ireland. And is it true, Chuck? You know, people should never have heard of Chuck. He's the best known AA in the world. And as Sybil said, we will have his tapes to listen to, and that's grand. He will leave a big hole in many areas, but probably the biggest hole that I know he will leave to people like me. Two items in it. One, people like me, and I presume like you, are going to have to remember he would have taken that action, so I better take it. That's the testament of Chuck Chamberlain. He was out on the front lines doing it. I know a month or two ago when he was so sick, and I said, don't come up to our group on Halloween. It's too far to come. And here he came in, Pierre wheeling him in, his things up his nose. I wouldn't miss this. And I wanted to just cry. I just wanted to cry. And people came over to touch his skin just in admiration. And Elsa's done such a wonderful job of taking care of him and being his friend. That's something else I think we ought to remember, too. Because I'm the next to the last speaker, and I want to get it all in. Because the next speaker won't tell you these things. But Chuck gave me inspiration. He gave me inspiration. If my clothes were on fire, and I called Chuck, he would say, you know, it isn't any big deal. You just accept it. And, you know, with love. But when my clothes were on fire, I wouldn't call Chuck. I'd call Elsa. She'd say, put out the goddamn fire. I never wanted to get any facts from Chuck. I wanted to get facts from Elsa. Inspiration from Chuck, facts from Elsa. Just always the way it was. But he will leave a big hole in inspiration to all of us. But we can remember it, and we can carry it forth to those who come behind us. I feel a little sad because there's a lot of people in our group who know Chuck Chamberlain, but they know him as an old, sickly, feeble man. And you will never have known him as a dynamic, charismatic man who literally lit up a room when he stood at a podium. I remember a few years ago, Elsa and Chuck and I went to Rapid City, South Dakota, and he was so sick, and I had to push him through the Denver airport in a wheelchair because it's light air, and Elsa had the flu, and I pulled her. And I never got a tip or nothing. And we got up there. And we got another guy, and I got Chuck some air tanks, which he ever had all the time on the road, because he had to sleep with the oxygen in his feet, or else he could not get up in the morning. And in the middle of the night, the oxygen died. Remember that night? And he could not breathe in the morning, and we were so sad and shocked. And all day long, I just could not get that oxygen back. And that night, I said, you better not speak, Chuck. He said, you got it. And he gray and pale and sat at this table. And our speaker tonight is Chuck C. And everybody clapped. And he got up. And the color poured into his cheeks. And his eyes lit up. Just, I'm Chuck C. and I'm an alcoholic. And he just gave it to him for an hour and a quarter, and I just cried with love and sat down and took him back to his room and could not breathe. I'll tell you, he was a fire horse. We'll miss his inspiration, but something else I will miss. I will not miss it. I'll try to do something about it. I hope you will too. I said this before too, but I want to say it one more time. The best testament you and I can give to Chuck Chamberlain tomorrow or next week or next month is to take a minute and talk to someone who is not up to our standards, who we ordinarily would brush by, who is obviously not of our type, someone who is not up to our classification of good AA member. Be a little more kindly just once in a while. Take a couple minutes a week, whether you like to or not, and be gracious. Do make that little effort, the extra handshake, the extra pat on the back, because I'll tell you, all of us doing it together may fill that hole, but it's going to take all of us, because he did it for everybody, and people like me do it for hardly anybody. It's going to require work. I am not sorry that Chuck Chamberlain's passed away, personally. I am sorry that that dynamic, charismatic man no longer exists. But the man that passed away was an old, tired, feeble man whose job was done, and I can't think of a better way to die than that he did. Sitting in that same chair, looking at the same ocean, closing your eyes and being taken away. We should know that there's a God by that reward that Chuck C. got from the God he believed in. So I think what we can do, when we hear the next speaker, the closing speaker of today's meeting, let's think about being kind. And maybe... No, you don't know what I mean. I know what I mean, but you don't know what I mean. When you hear the next speaker, you will understand what I mean. Think about being kind after you leave here. Of making sure you take the action you said you would take, even though it's inconvenient. Of doing the things that we were taught by perhaps the best AA you and I will ever know. That's what we can do for him. Thank you.
You know, when Chuck was very sick in the hospital, I went to see him one day, and he was, like Eddie was saying, he was really in bad shape that day, it seemed like to me, and he called me over to the bedside. I was getting ready to go, and he said, "Do you love me, son?" And I said, "Yeah, Pop, I love you." And he said, "Then tend my sheep." And I said, "What?" I didn't think I heard him correctly, because he said, "Do you love me, son?" And I said, "Yeah, Papa." And he said, "Well, then tend my sheep." And for the next 6 or 7 months, every time I saw him, I used to go tell him that I was getting tired of tending his sheep and for him to get up off the bed and go do it himself. And he got a big kick out of that, and I got a big kick out of that. But I've been thinking about that a lot, about what he said. And I've made it my own personal thing to try to carry out the standards that he gave me to live by 25 years ago sitting in a penitentiary. That man has been the standard that I've lived by for 25 years. Not trying to be like him or trying to emulate him or be him. Just the example and the standards that I live by. And although I fall far short of it, I think maybe now that the hole is there that Clancy just talked about, maybe I can take my part and fill that thing in there. And I'd like to tell you this before I introduce the next speaker to you. I know this. And he told me many, many times this, and I believe it, and I want to emulate it to you this afternoon, what he said to me. The little room that everybody talked about that he's going into, when I get there and I go to that room, whatever room it is, if there ain't people like you and people like my papa and flowers and pretty birds, I don't think I want to go in there. I'll just stay here with you until that comes to pass. And now I'd like to introduce the closing speaker for you this morning, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do.
And you know something? I can only do two things. Now, many of you might say, "Well, you talk a good battle. Yeah, yeah, yeah," you know? But this is the way I live. I can only do two things. You see, I can't run my life. I had 43 years to run my life and ended up in the bottom of the snake pit. So I'm not concerned with that. I can't do it. But I can do two things. I can practice these principles in all of my affairs this day to the best of my ability. In business, in home, in church, in play, in AA, the whole works. This I can do, and this I do do. And that's number one. And number two, I can share me with anybody that wants me in love. In all of my relationships. Sharing my experience, strength, and hope with anybody that wants it. In love. And that's number two. And that's all I can do. But it must be pretty close to right. Because I never had it for good. Don't be afraid of this program. Don't be afraid to abandon yourself completely to this simple program. Because there is sobriety here. There is the AA way of life here. There is peace. There is serenity. There is love. And there is God. What more could a man ask?
God is love, and he that abideth in love abideth in God. And God abideth in him. And so I'm so grateful to you, I can't see. I love you. It's my joy to have had this weekend with you. And I shall never forget it. Because some part of every one of you is going to be with me for the rest of my life. So I thank you again. And all I have to do is to look in the eyes of a bunch like this to see my God. God bless you. Thank you very much.
I would like you to stand and join hands and join me in praying the Lord's Prayer.